We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. On Perpetual Chess, I have weekly conversations with the chess world's best players, promoters, and educators about their lives, careers, current projects, and best practices. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. Hey, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have another great guest this week. She is the former U.S. Women's Chess Champion. These days, she's also a lecturer at the University of Texas at Dallas, where she has a PhD in education, and she has written 7 chess books and writes for U.S. Chess and other well-known chess online entities. So Dr. and WIM Alexi Root, thank you for joining us this week.
Thank you. Let me clarify one thing. My PhD is from UCLA, but I do work for UT Dallas.
Okay. Yeah. I knew that. I may have misspoken, but hopefully, wouldn't be my first error and won't be my last. So, thanks for the clarification. And we were talking or emailing back and forth a little bit about UTD because as we record, we're recording this Sunday night and the Final Four of chess here in the United States just took place, which for those who don't know, mimics the college basketball Final Four and the top four chess teams in the United States get together and play a little tournament to see who the collegiate champion is. And I know that you had a rooting interest in this. So did you catch any of the action? I know it was in New York, but were you watching from your home in Texas, Alexi?
Absolutely. I was watching online, very excited. And your listeners probably know by now that UT Rio Grande Valley won with an impressive score of 9 points out of 12 possible. Because there's 3 rounds and 4 students play each round. So maximum is 12 possible, and they got 9. So just a commanding performance. Congratulations to them.
Yeah, and UTD got 2nd. Is that right?
I wish. UTD got third. So with 6.5 points, Webster was second, Webster University. And then 5.5 points was UT Dallas. And 3 points was Harvard.
Okay. And of course, we've had guests from, I believe, every program. I think that Grandmaster Mauricio Ruiz went to UT Rio Grande, if memory serves. And of course, John Bartholomew is one of the many chess players who went to UT Dallas. Which one am I forgetting already? Webster, of course. The fabled Webster has had so many strong chess players, but Eric Rosen among, I mean, he's not the strongest, but one that I'm the friendliest with, is one of the many Webster U players who has passed through there as these chess powerhouses are built up. So Alexi, this is something that we emailed about a little bit, but so we know that you're a lecturer at University of Texas at Dallas. So are you involved with the chess program at all?
Let me just backtrack to your last point. Have you ever had anyone on from Harvard? Because remember, they were in the
final. Oh, well, I've had Christopher Chabris, who, he went to Harvard and I'm guessing he played on the chess team. I mean, he was a master, and he's he's not a young Turk. He's older like us. So that was back when being a USCF master meant that you were probably going to be one of the strongest players at your college. So I am guessing that he played for the Harvard chess team, but we will have to fact check that with him. He's probably going to listen at some point. So Chris, let us know.
Okay, great. Well, that sounds good. And so I'm sorry, you were going to ask me about the chess program at UT Dallas?
Well, yeah. How I know that you said that you have friendly relations with them and then you help them with some stuff. So what's your relation with them?
Okay, well, actually, when I first started at UT Dallas from 1999 to 2003, I was the associate director of the chess program in charge of recruiting. But then in 2003, I left that position, which was a volunteer position, and just concentrated on my actual job, which is teaching education courses for interdisciplinary studies at UT Dallas. However, my courses are about chess and education. So whenever the chess team has a pep rally or has the Chess Educator of the Year event or has coming up this Thursday an intramural tournament, I offer my online students, because all my students are online, extra credit to show up in person at these events. And I show up too because I want to meet my students in person, and I love the chess program events that are put on.
Okay, so you've been there for a long time. Was the UTD program fairly new at that point?
That's a great question. Yes, it started in 1996. So
okay.
In 99, it was still pretty new.
Yeah, I remember. So I went to college in 1995, and my good friend Greg Shahadi got a scholarship to UMBC, although he only went there for less than a year. And that was back, they were sort of at the vanguard. I mean, I remember it was UMBC and then University of Texas at Dallas. And now there's so many schools, especially in Texas and St. Louis, supporting chess. So do you remember many details about how the program came into being?
Well, actually, it's easy for your listeners because on our UT Dallas chess program webpage, there's a link called History. But just briefly, Tim Redman, who's also a former U.S. Chess Federation president, is a literary studies professor at UT Dallas. And some students approached him just to start a chess club. But Tim Redman is a visionary, and he didn't see just a chess club. He saw an entire chess program. And that's, along with UMBC, UT Dallas and UMBC really were the top college teams for quite a few years. And as you pointed out, now there's so many.
Yeah, not just so many, but they're so strong. I mean, just grandmaster after grandmaster. It's great to see.
I agree. It really gives K through 12 students here in the United States and internationally a chance to have what only athletes or maybe other prized recruits had before, which is a chance to go to university, all expenses paid, because of one's chess. And that being said, you also have to meet the college entrance requirements for whatever college you're entering. But still, it's very exciting, I think, for chess players to have the opportunities that people in athletic sports have.
Yeah, and it's such a life-changing opportunity. I mean, I can just think of a few guests that I've had on the show. And again, there have been so many that have made their way to the United States thanks to these chess programs. But again, Mauricio Ruiz, it certainly, when I got a chance to interview him, he talked about how it was a life-changing opportunity for him. Elshan Moradi-Abadi, sorry, Elshan, as well, and the list goes on. And of course, there are so many strong players who I haven't had a chance to talk to that I would love to about the opportunities it presents. And you know, just getting to go to New York for a weekend, as these players did. I mean, they had Irina Krush and Maxim Dlugy announcing for U.S. Chess these last couple of days, and beautiful weather. I'm not too far from New York, so I can attest they had some beautiful weather. Hopefully got to enjoy that a little bit. So yeah, it's a lot of fun. And, you know, hopefully this is only the beginning of even more and more chess programs building up. I know that Christian Carrillo has now been hired by University of Missouri. So they're it'll be interesting to see what they do in terms of building a program.
Well, they have $800,000 from Rex Sinkfeld to start their program.
Ah, mystery solved. Thank you for... I can't say that that's a huge shock, but I did not know that.
Oh, okay. And let me give you a little bit of trivia. Christian Carrillo, who's at University of Missouri Columbia, and Alejandro Ramirez, who's at St. Louis University as a coach, and Julio Zadora, who's at UT Dallas as a chess coach, all took my online courses back when they were students.
Ah, okay. Yeah, small world. All UTD alums, correct?
That's correct.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just so many... influential and strong chess players have passed through UTD, and as it turns out, have taken your courses. So you say you have a PhD in education, and your classes are multidisciplinary studies. Is that right?
Interdisciplinary studies. It's a division of the university. Some schools call it general studies, but that's my dean is the dean of interdisciplinary studies. That's who I work for. And education courses come under his purview. And so my courses are education courses with a focus on how chess can be used as an educational tool.
Okay. And so, and why is it that these courses are conducted primarily online? Is it to reach a wider base of students?
Well, initially, when Tim Rendon was still director of the chess program, there was an organization called UT Telecampus, which was to offer online education at all the different UTs, because you may know UT Austin, UT Dallas, UT Arlington. There's a whole system of University of Texas universities. So UT Telecampus came and made a presentation at our university in 2001 saying that they wanted to develop online courses. And they described what would be an ideal online course. And Tim Redman and I were sitting in the presentation, and we looked at each other and we thought, chess. So we actually got a $50,000 grant to develop the courses and offer them through UT Telecampus. Well, UT Telecampus has gone away, and now each university in the UT system offers their own online learning. And so now my courses are offered through UT Dallas e-learning. But that's how it got started, as an online course, is we had a grant.
Okay, that makes sense. And how did you take an interest in, I mean, I know how you took, I've read some of your writing about how you got into chess as a girl, and your experiences becoming a strong player and going on to win the U.S. championship. But how did you get interested in education?
Well, that's a good question, too. I did try law school for a while because both my parents are lawyers. My dad was a dean of a law school, and he was also a professor of law. And my mom went to law school late in life. So I kind of just, perhaps due to a lack of imagination, thought, well, I should be a lawyer
right.
too. But that wasn't a good fit for me. And so then I was kind of casting around for what to do. And I decided to go into teaching, which I'd already done some chess teaching. And so I found that I also liked teaching other subjects. So I became a social studies and English teacher at the high school level for a couple of years before I went for my PhD.
Okay. And were you doing any chess teaching like at that time? Did you do programs at the schools or not at that moment?
When I was a high school teacher at Bakersfield High School in California, shout out to the Drillers.
Nice.
Their symbol is that oil derrick, you know, because there's oil there. So anyway.
Okay. Bakersfield, or there was at least.
Drillers, yeah. Yes. I did run the after school chess club. So I was doing chess in that sense. And I was actually a pretty active player while I was a high school teacher as well.
Okay. And these days, do you do much in the way of like school programs? I mean, I know you've written a lot about kids and chess chess education, but besides your role for UTD, do you do anything with the younger students?
Yes, I think it's good for me to keep myself fresh about what younger students are like. So in the summers, I teach at summer chess camps, and those have ranged in age from, you know, 5 and 6 years old up through around 14 years old. So I do teach in that capacity in the summers.
Okay. And you've written a lot about chess education, the benefits of chess, how chess can be used in different fields. Do you have any current projects? I mean, I know you mentioned you're headed to the U.S. Junior High Nationals shortly, but are you working on anything writing wise right now?
Right now I've been writing articles as ideas come to me, but I'll have to tell you that one of my students last semester, I can back up and tell you a little bit about my two courses because that might make this next story make sense, if that's okay.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so my first course, ED 4358, is students writing lesson plans that include chess, and then they reflect on those plans. And in both of my courses, they have to play chess with each other and notate and annotate. But so the basic idea of the first chess course, 4358, is writing lesson plans, teaching those lesson plans, and then reflecting on how it went. The second course, ED 4359, is to either begin a chess program at an institution or suggest improvements to an existing chess program. So last semester, an ED 4359 student happened to be a parent of a Head Start child, and she wrote her whole paper about let's introduce chess at Head Start, and actually she got so excited about it, she arranged a meeting for me with the top officials of Head Start Greater Dallas. So I don't know if anything will come of it, but if it does, my next effort might be chess four- and five-year-old. We'll see what happens.
Wow. Yeah. Head Start. What is that for? It's one of those things. First of all, I should know what it is, but I'm sure there are a few listeners like me as unaware as I am. So.
Oh yeah. Sorry about that. So actually one of your prior guests, Elliot Neff, has worked with Head Start in Washington State. It's a federal program for 3 to 5 year old children. So preschool children. And I'm not sure exactly what the income guidelines are for it. I think it is aimed to give lower income children a head, quote unquote, head start on being successful students once they enter kindergarten through 12th grade. So, I hope that answers it.
Yeah. It's one of those things where it's like, that would have been my guess, but I wasn't positive, and I figured I'm not the only one. So, and I do remember Elliot Neff talking about developing the curriculum for very young kids. And obviously, as you say, like being a national program, that's a big deal if that comes to fruition. And I'm sure it would keep you quite busy.
Well, Elliot has done some wonderful work with that up in Washington State, and I definitely was in touch with him via email when Head Start of Greater Dallas showed an interest. So Head Start of Greater Dallas is still deciding whether or not they want chess. They're considering it. And then once they decide, they'll have to decide, should we go with Elliot Neff's curriculum that he's already developed, or do we want something local here. And so it's just something exciting to think about. I don't know what will ultimately come out of it, but in terms of a big project, if that actually comes through, that would be pretty big. Even if I was only an evaluator, say if they did adopt Elliot Neff's curriculum and I was brought in to evaluate how it went, that's still a big project. So.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I'm sure you have at least some experience writing and working with younger kids. Do you have sort of a framework in mind of what your major points would be? Like what advice? We have a lot of chess teachers, of course, who listen to this show, and I work with some younger students as well. So what advice do you have for people who are teaching like really young, say 4 to 6-year-old students?
Well, and you probably already do this, but start with just 1 or 2 chessmen at a time. For example, maybe just rooks and kings, and you can spend time with what is check, what is checkmate. You can set up skewers with rooks and kings. So just keeping it very simple at the beginning, and there's definitely some great resources out there for teaching younger children. Is that what you've been doing with the younger ones? Is that just limiting it to a couple pieces at a time?
Yeah, I try to keep things as simple as possible. But where I think I need to improve is the mini games. I mean, because it takes so long for them to be able to move at that age, all of the pieces that I need to up my mini game for them in terms of like little activities that they can do. Because with older kids, you can give them very directed puzzle sheets, even 7-year-olds. But younger kids, a lot of them can't read. And even when they can read, there's something very daunting about handing them a piece of paper and wanting them to follow the instructions. So I try to steer away from that. And that leaves like a small void to be filled.
Yeah, I agree. And some of my books have those type of games, like you probably already do a pawn game, which is just pawns against pawns, and whoever promotes first wins. You know, that's it, the end. Just see what happens.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, those, I do have some of those already in my books, and so I think that they could be adapted for the pre-K set, so.
Yeah, and of course the steps method is full of ideas as well.
Yeah. So, do you have more questions about other things?
Well, I have a related question. I'm sort of rattling around. I know that recently, Elizabeth Spiegel, a friend of mine who I'm sure you know as well, posted that she'd done a speech down, and it was at UTD, correct?
That's
Chess for Chess Educator of the Year.
Yes. Yes.
And I know that Jeff Bullington, who was featured on 60 Minutes, won it in the past. Do you get a chance? Did you introduce her? Or am I making that up?
I was there. I did not introduce
okay.
her.
Okay. Oh, right.
But I was definitely there, and I'm going to be, actually, I've already turned it in. I wrote an article about her presentation for the May issue of Chess Life.
Okay. Good. Yeah, it deserves a wide audience. It was a great presentation.
I agree. It was a really great presentation, and it was very well attended because she is a chess celebrity with Brooklyn Castle. So I've been able to go to every one of the Chess Educator of the Year evenings, and that was, again, something started by Tim Redman that back in 2004 was the first Chess Educator of the Year at UT Dallas.
Yeah, well, good for him. It's a great initiative. And the speeches are online, so listeners, I'll link to a couple of them in the show description. So Alexei, I know we've got a few topics that we need to hit. So you're heading to the Junior High Nationals as part of the initiative to promote chess to scholastic girl players.
That's right. I noticed that the National Junior High was in Grapevine, Texas, which is right around the corner from me. And I become aware that girls club rooms are offered at all the national scholastics. So I emailed with the women's committee chair, Maureen Grimaud, and asked if I could be a special guest for the girls club room at the National Junior High. And I'm excited that she said yes. So along with Katerina Nemkova, we're the two special guests for that girls club room.
Cool. Yeah. Oh, awesome. Yeah. And Katarina, I haven't met her in person, but I've had very good interactions with her online. So shout out to her. I think that the young girls there will be in good hands. And listeners, take note of Dr. Alexi Root, PhD and former U.S. women's chess champion. She's still a go-getter, still going to get that opportunity for herself and offering her services, not waiting to be summoned, right?
Oh yeah. You can't wait to be summoned, that's for sure. And as long as I was going to the girls' club room, I kind of went a little overboard maybe in what I've taken on, because I'm also doing a book signing Saturday from 4 to 6. And I asked Melinda Matthews, the editor of Chess Life, can I write the report on the tournament? So we'll see if I'm able to juggle all these varying roles. But I'm very excited to try.
Yeah, it's great. And I'm pretty excited about all the initiatives they're doing in women's chess. And obviously that's a topic I've, you know, talked about with various guests. So over the years that I've been doing this podcast. But one thing I'm curious about with your perspective, Alexi, having, you know, been a strong player coming up and then seen different generations come up, do you have any theories? So we know that the chess world hasn't been as welcoming to women as men over the years, but do you have any theories for do you think that women are less interested in chess to begin with, or do you think that they get turned away as if their interest is initially piqued?
Well, that's a great question. I think that there's a huge drop off of both boys and girls right around age 14. So both, you know, that I was just looking at some statistics. Did you know the peak year for being a U.S. chess member is age 10? Like, that's the peak. And then it drops.
Oh, interesting. That.
So, but I do think that it tends to drop off more for girls, because if you see fewer girls around and you have less friends in chess, then, you know, as time goes on, if you're like, you may be one of several girls playing at your elementary, but then if you get to middle school or high school and you're the only girl, that may not be as comfortable or pleasant a situation. And there's so many other options for children in high school that I think it's hard to retain the interest at that point.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you say the age of 14, because I was thinking when you said it, I was thinking in my experience with girls, it might be a little earlier. I was thinking around 12, but then as I think about it, of course, like girls hit puberty at a younger age than men. So I don't know how much that has to do with it, but it's at least a possibility that in addition to there being, especially historically, but even now, fewer girls playing to begin with. But then, as you say, when it starts to drop off, I think it takes either a burning passion for the game or a strong personality in order to stick with it at that point. Although it's, you know, it's great that these initiatives, I think, will definitely help.
I think so, too. I mean, it'll be interesting to see what happens to those statistics over the next few years, because, you know, we can look and see if there's more retention or growth or all those things. And Jennifer Shahade is the Women's Chess Program Director for U.S. Chess, so she's going to be pushing this mission, and there's a very active women's committee. So we'll see what happens. It'll be interesting.
Yeah, it will be. What changes have you seen over your life in terms of how women are received in the chess world? Hopefully you've seen some.
Well, in terms of prize money, because that's something measurable, I guess. When I won the U.S. Women's in 1989, the first prize was $2,000. Now, I do have to say that they paid airfare and fed us and housed us. So the value of it, I think, is a little greater than 2000 because of all those that was included. And the first prize now for the U.S. women is 25,000, but I don't know if they have to pay their own hotel and airfare and everything to get to St. Louis. So,
yeah.
But I mean, obviously it's gone up, you know, from
Yeah, although I'm trying to call up like an inflation adjuster, because if anything, I, given the more prominent role that women's chess, at least as far as from my perspective, has taken, I might have guessed a bigger difference, because only because, I mean, to, obviously nominally it sounds like a huge difference, but when you account for inflation, I'm curious. So it was 1989, is that right?
Yes, 30 years.
All right, listeners, here you go. We're going to get a live calculation from this random website.
Okay.
Just because otherwise my curiosity would get the best of me.
And that, and that price one was actually a big jump up that year. They were hoping to attract some of the recent players that had immigrated to the country to play. But instead, they got me winning it. So,
Okay. Well, my math is... Well, I mean, it's still an accomplishment. I mean, anytime you're playing the best players in a country, it's nothing to downplay. But one could definitely downplay my ability to calculate inflation rates, because it turns out that if you bought something in 1989, if I purchased according to usinflationcalculator.com, something, a website I never thought I would be name checking on this podcast, but here we are. If you purchased an item for $2,000 in 1989, it would now be $4,000. So obviously that's a huge difference, from today's prizes. So yeah, that makes a big difference. And, it'll be interesting. I mean, if you just look at an example of, is Jennifer Yu, who ran roughshod through the tournament this year. I saw Mike Klein mention she got an almost perfect score on the SATs. Obviously, going to have a lot of opportunity in life. So it'll be interesting to see how big a role chess plays with the increased opportunity for women to play chess. But still, I mean, she'll have other opportunities as well. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out for her and other young talents.
Yeah, let me ask you a question about that, because didn't How You Fan kind of stop playing chess to go to Oxford, or am I misremembering that?
You are not imagining that. That is a thing that is happening. Yeah. And obviously with state support in China, it can be, she might be under even less pressure, one would think, financially, but at least for the time being, she's not a chess professional. It seems like I know when I talked to Judith Stray out in the Bay Area, they had her do an event. She still does chess events and stuff, but I believe she was invited to the Cairns Cup and wasn't able to play. So it's definitely not her focus right now.
Well, if you're saying this about Jennifer Yu being so academically talented too, then, you know, you kind of wonder if How You Fan chose academics, maybe someone like Jennifer Yu will as well. So I don't know. It is interesting. So many different directions that some of these very talented top women are going to be pulled in as life goes on.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's only slightly less stark for men. For the population at large, if you're top 10 in the world or something, that's the point where, you know, it seems I would question the decision to not pursue chess. But anything short of that, I think that one could make an argument in either direction. Although certainly as a chess fan, I'm always hoping for the top players to keep playing.
Yeah, it can be a hard decision because, you know, if you have other interests or other fields pay so much better, at what point do you stop playing chess all the time? I mean, a lot of people go into chess teaching, but I'm sure, as you know, as a chess teacher, that's not the same as working on your own game and playing for yourself. So even going into chess teaching is kind of stepping away from playing.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing about chess teaching is once you attain a level like these players have played, even in your example, having gotten a PhD in education, but even if you hadn't, you would have had opportunities to teach chess. But when you're young and can go to either get a scholarship somewhere or go to an elite institution or both, that's something that it's best to take advantage of when you're young. And then if you still pursue chess, that's great. But you might as well take advantage of the opportunities you have when you have them.
Well, that's what's so nice about all these college scholarships available is that it allows these talented young players to keep their hand in chess and still play top level competitions like the Final Four of College Chess, but pursue their degrees. So it's really a wonderful, as you said, wonderful opportunity for young chess players.
Yeah, and as you say, it'll be interesting to see how things evolve over time, both in terms of what effect these great initiatives that U.S. Chess and other supporters of chess throughout the world have launched, and in terms of where these young women and where other top young players end up spending the bulk of their professional time. We will stay tuned and track it as the years go on. So, of course, Alexei, as someone who has heard some interviews on this show, you know we're going to talk chess improvement. So I prepped you and told you I'd be asking for some book recommendations, and I know that you've got a few ready. You even sent me the links in advance. So other prospective guests, take note. Alexei is she's very diligent, and I really appreciate it. So Alexei, first of all, let's start with your playing. When you were working hard to improve and playing a lot, what were your most formative chess books?
Oh, see, now I didn't include those in my list. So now we'll have to do some work. So
it's okay. I'll track them down.
Actually, I was fortunate enough to be interviewed for Chess Life Kids in October 2018. And so they also asked that, or Melinda Matthews also asked me that same question, which books made an impression on me as a kid. And to be honest, one of the ones that I loved as a child was How to Win in the Chess Opening by I.A. Horowitz. And there was another book he wrote, too, with the same type of format. And it had what he called movies. Like, it was just diagrams and the moves underneath them. But it was a movie of a different opening. That was the way he styled it. And I just loved it.
Interesting.
I just loved watching that.
So could you explain that? I don't think I read this. If I did, it was 30 years ago. What do you mean by there were movies of a chess opening?
Well, it has been a while since I've looked at it, and I don't even know if I still own it. But what I remember is that you'd have a diagram, and I mean, if it was the Roy Lopez opening, Horowitz would make up a movie style storyline about the opening. And so you would
Okay.
the opening through the diagrams and read, the adventures that happened during this Roy Lopez opening. At least that's how I remember it. So that was when I was just starting out. Now, my first chess coach, Lauren Schmidt, who was in Lincoln, Nebraska, he's an FM. He had me working with him on my system during the chess lessons as a 9-year-old. And I remember that being really like hard work. And,
yeah.
and looking back at it, I feel like perhaps maybe he was getting something out of it too. Like, let me just teach this 9-year-old the thing that I want to study here or something. But,
right.
But we did do some my system, but I would not have put that as, my favorite book, although I remember about overprotecting. I do remember something about that. But one book I liked as a teenager was Leonid Stein, Master of Attack by, I think it was Raymond Keene, but I'd have to double check that. And it was just Leonid Stein died young, but he was a great Soviet player. And at the time I was playing a lot of G3 openings and G6 openings for black, and he played those openings and he won, and I just thought, wow, this is really exciting. So I like that book.
Okay. Yeah, I know that he's like a kind of, he's a legend in the chess world. I mean, he's one of the what could have beens if he had stuck around longer. And what about more up to, more current favorites of yours?
So now we get to the list I actually sent you. Okay, good.
Yes.
All right. Well, I'm lucky enough to have occasionally reviewed books, as John Hartman mentioned. And when you review books, publishers send you books for free, which is really exciting to get free books. And a couple of books that were sent to me in that way that I really liked were Judith Polgar, How I Beat Fisher's Record. And that's a 2012 book. And I know there's follow-ups to that book, like it was the first of her series, but I really enjoyed that book.
All three of her books are great. All three of those are awesome. It's a good combination of like memoir and amazing chess.
Exactly. I really like books that have narration, you know, stories about chess, stories about biographies of the players, you know. And so I'm thinking, I don't have the Lena Stein book anymore, but I'm thinking it must have had that for me to be so interested in it. And then these two authors have made a splash recently with their AlphaZero book, but Matthew Sadler and Natasha Reagan's book, Chess for Life, from 2016. I got a review copy, and I really enjoyed that book. They had a lot of tips for players in their 40s and 50s, and examples and stories. And I often think to myself, if I was actually interested in improving my chess, I should go back and study that book, because it had tips for what openings you should play and how to approach endgame study. So I was pretty excited about that book.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that one as well. So even when I was lucky enough to get them on this show on their little Game Changer press junket, I wasn't going to let them do this interview without talking about that book as well, especially because I know the topic of adult improvement in chess is of interest to a lot of listeners to the show as well. So, Alexi, I know that you had kids. Are your kids grown now?
Or? They are. They're adults.
Oh, you sound so forlorn.
Oh, yeah. Enjoy the time. I know you have a young child. Enjoy that time. It's really,
yeah, I've got two young ones, but I mean, often I'm forlorn at the end of the day too. So, okay. I mean, it's wonderful, but exhausting. But what I was going to ask is you say if you were pursuing your chess, and I'm just out of curiosity, do you have any inkling to get back in the ring and play again?
What's been really nice about this Girls and Women's Chess Initiative is that more and more tournaments for girls and women are popping up, and whenever they do, I feel obligated to support them, because I think it is important. So that's actually gotten me playing a little bit more. And what's been neat is that I played in a Texas Women's Championship, and the four daughters of one of the players, the mom had me posing for photos with the daughters, and they all had lots of questions and wanted my autograph. And so that's nice, but, you know, on an ego perspective, but I also do feel it's important for me to show up at these events to be a inspiration or role model for any younger players that show up. And also, since I'm not at my peak strength anymore, they can maybe even defeat me, and then they can say, oh, former U.S. Women's Chess. So I've been playing in those tournaments, and if organizers offer me good conditions at open tournaments, I always jump on that, because I think, well, if they're generous enough to offer me a free entry, then, you know, who am I to say no? That's really nice of them. So that's a hot tip out there for any organizers.
Yeah. Okay. So it sounds like you've still got your toe in the water.
Well, just, you know, if the right opportunities come along, absolutely. I love playing chess. I heard you talk on one of the podcasts about how you were very absorbed in a chess book and didn't realize your hotel room was flooding. That's how I feel during chess games. I love it.
Yeah.
That's just great to be so absorbed in something, because in my normal life, which is basically spent online because I teach online, it's so easy to get distracted by, oh, there's a new student assignment that's just been posted or just been emailed to me. Or, you know, it's just not the same as focusing all in on a chess game.
Yeah, you're very responsive to emails, I must say, at least in our handful of interactions.
Yes, that about me, because I, you know, I promise them turnaround on their assignment within 48 hours, and I usually do it even faster than that. And they're like, wow, we've never had a professor who like detailed critiques so quickly, but, you know.
Yeah, well, there's something about the chess player personality, I think, that goes along with like spending a lot of time online. So I just think that there's sort of a natural now that's an opportunity that's available. You know, now that spending a lot of time online is a thing, I think that naturally, you know, even people like Hikaru Nakamura is, you know, on the computer all the time. You know, not out at the club or anything like that. And yeah, I just think there's something about whatever the Venn diagram of things that connect chess players, there's a strong component of people who like to be alone in a room, but being online obviously allows you to feel connected and to pursue your interests as well.
That's a good point. Okay, I'll agree with that.
No, you don't sound so convinced, but that's okay.
No, I mean, I certainly don't mind being alone in a room with and being online, because there's so much to keep busy with that. So yeah, I think that's a valid point.
Okay, I mean, it's just something I've observed in my experience, but I could be wrong. So you've written stuff from the perspective of a parent and given advice to chess parents. So I know we have at least some chess parents who like to listen to this show. So what advice do you give to them, Alexi?
Well, you know, my number one advice is always think safety. Make sure that you don't leave your child one-on-one with a chess teacher. It's just not a good idea. And then, you know, Elizabeth Spiegel gave this advice during her talk too, which is sit in on the prospective teacher's lessons as a parent. Sit in and observe, and maybe try out several different teachers and talk to your child about what's a good fit. So I think that's a start. I don't know what other things you want me to mention, but.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. I mean, for listeners, I mean, you've been on the record writing about you were a victim of abuse as a teenager. So I just want to give it a full airing since you've written about it and you've been open about it, and I think it's great that you're an advocate now to make sure, because obviously as a parent, that's your number one priority is the safety of your child.
Yes, and you know, I have to credit Jennifer Shahade for encouraging me to write about it, because as usual, you know, as you said, I like to look for opportunities to become involved in chess, so, and to, you know, get jobs in chess, to be frank. So I had, after my dad passed away in March of 2017, I wrote to her and I said, can I write a memoir about my life in chess and my dad, you know, and aim it for Father's Day? And she said, sure. And so I turned in an initial draft to her, which didn't include the sexual abuse story. All it included was the story that I told many times before, which was about being stopped at the border between the U.S. and Canada at age 13 with no evidence of who I was and was just a chess clock because I was headed on my Greyhound bus up to a chess tournament. And so she asked me after I emailed in like that much, what happened next? And I decided, and I'd never written about it before, okay, you know, my dad's passed away now, because I feel like it's a criticism of him to write about what happened to me because he sent me up there. So I hadn't written about it before, but I went ahead and wrote about what happened over time with the Canadian chess coach.
Well, I commend you for it. I mean, it was a really moving article, and, you know, we can't judge, at least I don't think parents should be judged with today's safety standards when this took place, you know, decades ago. I mean, even when I was a kid, I remember just, I mean, the whole culture around around kids being supervised was entirely different. So it was a moving memory of your dad, and I certainly wouldn't think that it's, I mean, it's awful, I mean, just unspeakably awful what you went through. But I don't know, from my perspective, your dad is not the primary person to blame for that.
Oh, of course not. But I just, I know that, you know, he felt some guilt about it, of course, you know, because, but for him letting me go up there, you know, it wouldn't have happened, right? So while he was alive, I didn't want to bring it back up again. And I really, when I emailed back and forth with Jennifer, I'm like, you know, I don't want to write this if it's going to bring shame on my family. I was really conscious of that. But she was very encouraging. She said, you know, this is an important message for other parents. And so she worked with me, and I am pleased with the final article, which was really framed with what parents can learn from my experience, because there's nothing that I can do to change my past and what happened to me. But if parents listening to this just are more careful about where their children are and who they're with, then that's a good thing, because once you have that happen to you, it changes your whole life in a bad way. So, you know, hopefully I can help other parents and children avoid what happened to me.
Yeah, I think it's quite commendable that you wrote about that. And I know that you mentioned in the article that this, of course, also impacted how you parented. Did you feel like you, as a parent, I gather you had a different approach?
Oh, absolutely. I had a very different approach. I mean, my dad, in the article I mentioned, he was kind of a free range. Is that the term, free range parenting, where?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Just go off.
Yeah. Versus helicopter.
Yeah. Well, I was much more the helicopter parent. I mean, my children didn't go on overnights, and like when I volunteered all the time at their schools, and I was always the chaperone on any trip, you know, so I was definitely right there all the time. And, you know, I've read about other people who've gone through this and then become parents, and they also tend to do that because they don't want it to happen to their own child. It's very, a very real thing they're trying to avoid for their own children.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's one of the greatest fears of every parent. So it's good that you make it a point of emphasis right away, because sometimes it goes unspoken just because it can be uncomfortable. But it needs to be said.
Well, I mean, if you just have the first criteria when you're choosing any program for a child is safety. And I really like Scouting has a good rule of thumb, which is that if there's one teacher, there should be at least two students in there, you know, and if there's two teachers, then there can be one student. So in other words, you never have one teacher and one student. There's always like two.
Yeah.
One. And that's not a perfect defense, obviously, but it helps. And so, you know, as parents for any program our children are in, just investigate. Is there always, you know, two or more adults with the kids, or if there's just one adult, are there multiple children? Like my kid's not left one-on-one with that teacher.
Yeah, just as a teacher, I try to always be in that situation, just because you from all sides, you don't want there to be any misunderstandings, and you want to make sure that everyone knows that you have a safe environment. So yeah, obviously the safety of the kids is the paramount concern, but just for any chess teachers listening, I think it's a general guideline for you yourself to try to make sure that you're always in those situations.
Oh, I agree, because you don't want to, as a chess teacher, put yourself one-on-one with a chess student, you know, obviously if it's where the doors are open and other people can see you, that's different, like, you know, but you don't want to be one-on-one with a chess student at your apartment and no one else is there. That's just not a good idea.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well said.
Thank you for being willing to talk about that, because, you know, ever since my coming out as a sex abuse survivor, I've tried to make it a point to bring it up. And, you know, hopefully it helps, at least in the chess world.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope so as well. There's just, it's so important because there are so many sexual abuse survivors, and relative to how many there are, it is not talked about very much. I mean, obviously for very understandable reasons, but I mean, if this is something we want to get better over time, talking about it, I think is the best. I mean, a step in the right direction.
I agree. And I have to say though, that I was definitely discouraged from talking about it for a number of years. So, you know, I think that whole idea of somehow, like if any other crime happens to you, like if someone steals your handbag or breaks into your house or beats you up, like there isn't the stigma, I don't think, of talking about it afterwards. But with this crime, somehow we stigmatize the victim. And
it's true.
And that makes it harder to talk about. I know when it happened to me and I finally did tell my parents, and as I wrote about, you know, my dad and I pursued it in front of the chess coaches professional board. Well, I had asked my dad, can we go to open court? Because I was all gung-ho to be like, let's make sure this never happens to another child. And my dad said, well, if we go to open court, your reputation will be ruined. And also, this chess coach's career in his outside profession will be ruined. And so now, you wouldn't think my dad would care about the chess coach's career, but as I started that essay, he was really a defense attorney at heart. And,
right.
You know, I start with the story that I grew up with, which is that, you know, he defended someone who killed three people and made a paraplegic out of the fourth and was willing to have that person, Dwayne Pope, come and stay at our house. So he was all about, no matter how awful your crime is, you deserve a second chance. And he felt that way about the person that abused me. And that was pretty mind-blowing for me even now, that was one reason we didn't go to open court, was number one, my reputation, which again, that gives me the message that it's something shameful if you say we can't go to open court because your reputation will be ruined. So that gives a certain message. But then also, we don't want to ruin this person's career. So we went for, because of my dad's guidance, we went for going in front of his professional board, and certain restrictions were placed on him as he practiced his profession, which was outside of chess.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, which... Yeah, better than nothing.
Exactly. I felt like I did something to help protect other children. And, you know, that was all I could do. I was a minor, you know.
Yeah.
So I wasn't able to run it the whole show myself in terms of how to proceed. And I am satisfied that at least something was done. And maybe that person got the message that he shouldn't do this in the future. You know, that's hopefully so. I don't know. I mean, one never knows, right? What happens.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like at least. And now I'm trying in a different way, which is just getting the message out to parents.
Right. Yeah. Which, again, it's a very important message, obviously. Well, Alexi, I really want to thank you for your time. I don't want to end on such a somber note. I mean, what's that?
I think we had a few other topics, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I mean, for one thing, I know that you had mentioned that you, piggybacking off of what John Hartman talked about last week, you mentioned that you could share your perspective on, if anyone's interested in finding work in the chess world or how you got your first book published, that you could tell us about that.
Absolutely. So my first book was... My online courses started in 2001. So when you teach an online course, you have to basically write out all the things you would lecture about in person. So I wrote out the whole course and taught it for 5 years, or actually about 4 years. And then I realized this could be a book. And I looked around for who could publish it and had some rejections. But then I met someone in a book group I was in. I was in a women's book group. And this person in the group, Kate Eaton, had published with ABC Clio, actually a division of ABC Clio, but she had written about Life in Russia was her book. And she says, I described my book and she's like, that sounds very interesting. Let me tell my editor about it. And so from that editor, another editor approached me and that's how the first book got published. So I'd already had it written, which is not completely the normal procedure for a nonfiction book, but that's how my first book got published by ABC Clio. And they're primarily published for librarians and educators. And so I was able to publish 4 more books with them. And then they were like, well, you know, that's probably enough chess and education books, because they're kind of competing against each other. Because if you're an educator or a librarian, you might just want one book on chess and education in your library, not 5. So I think hit my limit with that publisher.
Huh. But that's interesting to the perspective that it was outside of the traditional chess publishers. I mean, we have a few more than we used to, but still it's a fairly short list of chess publishing companies.
That's right. It was not a chess publisher. It was, a fairly big publisher, ABC Clio, for educators and librarians, and they didn't have any books on chess and education, and they got 5, and that was enough. But it was a great experience. And then I ended up writing 2 more books for a chess publisher called Mongoose Press, which I've enjoyed working with both ABC Clio and Mongoose Press.
And what about general advice for writing, if people who are interested in writing about chess?
Well, I'm going to copy John Hartman's advice. He said to write for your state magazine first, and that you probably won't get paid. And that's true. I mean, I wrote for Northwest Chess when I lived up in, I grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska till I was 11, and then my family moved to Washington State. So my teenage years were spent in Washington State, and then so I wrote articles for free for Northwest Chess. And then I moved to Southern California, and I wrote articles for free for Rank and File, which is a Southern California magazine. And then I moved to Texas, and I wrote articles for free for Texas Night. And I think I also wrote a couple articles for Michigan Chess, just because I had played some tournaments up there. But I did a lot of writing for free, and then had all that experience writing about chess, and then was able to write for Chess Life.
Okay, so you really paid your dues.
For a lot of years, yeah. I think actually one of my first articles for Chess Life was when I was U.S. Women's Champion, they invited me to write like one of the articles at the front of the magazine, because they were doing a membership drive. So they had different people every month writing about the membership drive. And I had a clever thing in there where I said, roll your chessboard so the squares face outward so everyone knows you're a chess player. You know, it's just a simple way to publicize chess.
Oh, like
clearing
nice.
Around your board, don't roll it with the squares inside, roll it with your squares showing. So that was,
yeah, I like it.
That was one of my tips for the membership drive, to be proud you're a chess player and show it off. So I think that was maybe the start of me writing some articles for Chess Life. But now I've written a lot for Chess Life and Chess Life Online and Chess Base. And I write for a site called Spark Chess, which is out of Romania. So I keep pretty busy with writing various articles, thank goodness, because I enjoy it. And I also do proofreading. I proofread for Mongoose Press and for Russell Enterprises, which is Hannah and Russell.
Oh, wow. Big publishing. Big chess publishers.
Yes. And
have you come across anything recently? Anything in the pipeline?
Well, the last book I proofread for Russell Enterprises was a book called The Bishop by Sergei Kasparov, not Garry Kasparov, but Sergei Kasparov. And I believe that The Bishop is turning into a whole series where each piece is going to get its own treatment. So,
huh.
Yeah.
Cool. What's the hook?
Well, I mean, the bishop, you just learn everything possible about the bishop, like all the different bishop endgames, like opposite color bishop end game, same color bishop end game, bishops in the middle game, you know, just everything about the bishop. So,
wow, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, I enjoyed proofreading that book. It was really good. So, and it was translated from the Russian, so I was proofreading the translation because I don't speak or read Russian. But then occasionally I'd have a question and I'd have to go back to the Russian and use a Google Translate and try to figure out, like, was the translation actually representing what this Russian author was trying to say? So that was a neat challenge. But, I don't know, would your listeners be interested in how much money all this stuff pays, or is that?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. So for writing, I generally get about 20 cents a word. It tends to be more for print publications and can be a lot less for some websites, but roughly 20 cents a word. And again, remember, this is after years of not getting paid at all. So,
So let's see. So if you write like a 3-page article, how many words would that be? What do you think?
You figure about 800 words a page.
So. Okay. So 2,400 times 20. that's like $50, right?
For a 3-page article? No, I don't.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Math right there. No.
Sorry. It's late here.
For 500 words, it's $100. So, and that's like a little more than half a page. So.
Okay.
So 20 cents a word. But,
okay.
And then for proofreading, I started out charging $30 an hour. Now I charge $35 an hour. And that's actually, considering I'm a subject matter expert, you know, that, which is hard to find like a general proofreader who can actually proofread chess books, because there's a lot of, I have to play through the lines and make sure they make sense and that there's not any missing moves. So that's what I'm
doing. Yeah, it's highly specialized.
For proofreading. So, and then, you know, since I now know I can make $35 an hour sitting at home with my computer doing proofreading, that kind of biases what chess camp teaching jobs I'll take. Because, I do enjoy teaching in person, but if it's going to be at less than $35 an hour, then I kind of think to myself, well, should I do it or not? And remember,
We're back to sitting alone in the room.
Yeah, exactly.
It all comes full circle.
Right. But rates can vary. I know chess teaching rates, per hour are probably a lot higher where you are. And for like a group class, I would definitely expect more than $35 an hour if it's like a one-shot deal, like 1 hour a week after school versus a whole camp day. If that makes sense.
Right. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Commuting to one school for 1 hour, that you have to figure that's, you know, your commuting time for something too, as opposed to having a whole day of a chess camp. So, you know, hopefully that's helpful to your readers or your listeners. I'm so used to writing. Sorry. Your listeners.
Oh, no.
Did any
no, and I do think
questions or I know we were kind of, I've been kind of a last minute guest, so you may not have gotten any questions in.
Yeah, we didn't get any questions. But it's not just you. Our my Patreon supporters, God bless them, have been slacking lately. So
okay. I thought yeah. Because I was like a last minute substitution. So all right, I won't take it personally.
No, well you would have been on sooner or later anyway. But we haven't been getting a ton of questions lately, which you know.
Well, let me
who knows
tell a story about that though that might make you feel good. So, you know, Dan Lucas started the Chess Life podcast, and originally when he started it, he had a trivia contest, and he wasn't getting many people trying for this trivia contest, even though the prize was a $50 gift certificate to U.S. Chess Sales. So all you had to do was answer the trivia question, and you'd win this certificate. So I suggested to him, why don't you be like Ben Johnson and Perpetual Chess Podcast and have a best question contest. And he did that. He started a best question contest where the prize is the $50 U.S. Chess Sales gift certificate. And he says that immediately doubled and tripled the amount of input from his listeners. Like, it was a great idea. So That was
good. Well, thank you.
You.
Glad to hear it. Yeah, and I do enjoy Dan's podcast, and he gets some good questions submitted as well.
Well, you know, he's offering the prize. Now, you're not in the same position he is, so you can't offer a prize, but I'm saying that I stole your idea of questions in,
yeah,
to him, so.
Well, I mean, what I tell myself is just that my own questions are just so amazing that the listeners are just like, I mean, how am I going to top it? There's no reason to send in a question.
I think that's really true. You know, you do ask great questions and you make your guests feel very comfortable, which I appreciate. And I've listened to quite a few of your podcasts and just want to commend you on doing such a great job. And it is a great honor to be your guest this time. So thank you.
Oh, well, thank you, Alexa. Yeah, and if anyone listening is at Junior High Nationals coming up in Texas, obviously, let Alexi know that you heard her. And Alexi, other than that, if people want to reach you, what is the best way for them to keep up with whatever you're doing?
Well, I think you're going to put up my Amazon page with all my books, right? So they can...
Yes.
And that has I try to put my upcoming appearances on that page. And I'm on Facebook, and I accept all friend requests on Facebook. And my email is public knowledge at the university there. So, and I have a Gmail too. I don't mind giving it, or if you want to put it on. I don't know how you do that on your website.
Yeah, whichever you prefer. And which one do I already have? Let's start with that.
You have my Gmail, and that's fine. You can put that up for people to get a hold of me. As opposed to my university email address. So either one works.
Okay.
All right.
Well, it all sounds good. And thank you, Alexi. I really appreciate your willing to talk about all things good and less good from your experiences.
Absolutely. And, you know, we didn't even get to talk about some of the other topics, like, you know, my chairing the Women's Chess Committee and all the things we did back then. So maybe if I'm very lucky, you'll have me back someday. So I hope.
Yeah, sounds good to me.
All right, thanks very much.
Thanks to everyone who makes Perpetual Chess possible. Of course, that includes Matthew Passy, my producer, and Geert Vandervelt for supplying the intro music. I also want to thank everyone who helps spread the word about the show. That includes people who tell their friends, tweet about it, share on Facebook. Apparently, Instagram is a thing. Every little bit helps grow the show. But most of all, I want to thank people who support the show financially. I've said this before, but Perpetual Chess is my most gratifying but least paying work. If everyone who listens to the show were able to kick in $1 a month, it would be my best paying and most gratifying work. So I want to thank those who are able to provide financial support. That includes extra special thanks to Chessable.com, Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, Dan O'Hanlon, Greg Shahadi, John Jernigan, and Todd Bryant. And I also want to thank all of my Patreon and PayPal perpetual partners. Here comes the list. You guys ready? Here we go. Ace Vallega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adam Vrancourge, Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, Benjamin Handelman, BetterChessTraining.com, Bill Moran, Brett Howard Lynn, Brian Mullis, I am Carlos Perdomo of ChessAtlanta.com, Chad Hilton, Chad Oliver, Chris Balcom, Chris Flanagan, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Shabri, Christopher Wood, good job, Christophers. I am Christoph Zalicki, a.k.a. Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Daniel Gell, Daniel Ginsburg, Daniel Lucas, Daniel Naylor, Daniel Schaefer. Good job, Daniels. Dave Saylor, David Cramley of Chessable.com, Dwayne Edmonds, Ethan Smith. I am Elect Donnie Ariel Esquire. Fox Valley Chess Club of Aurora, Illinois, Frank Tortoris, M.D., Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Geert Vandervelt, Gerard Barta, Giovanni Russo, Harish Srinivasan, GM Jakob Ogar of Quality Chess Publishing, James Bonastia, Jason Willem, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, Jen Shahadi, Jens Green, Jerry Wells, John Thompson, GM Josh Friedel, Kari Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, I am Kostya Kavrutsky, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Laura Belyavsky, Lucio Casada Silva, Matthew Passy, Martin Habich, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, the mysterious Moon Master 9000, Mr. Michael Shahadi, Nate Salon, Nathan Webster, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paolo Santana, Peter Lux, Peter Merrifield, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Rob Lazorchek of DiplomatChess.com, Robert Steiner, Ryan Berg, Scott Daugherty, Scott McKinnon, Steiner Lima, the Law Office of Stuart Katz, WGM Tatya Vabrahamian, Thomas Casper, Thomas Stanek, Thomas Tachenko, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com. His book is coming to Chessable. Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Victor Vrinkush, FM Zhao Cheng of Chess1000.com, and Zhivko Stoyanov. Thank you, everyone, and I will catch you all next week.
Podcast Network. Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.